So, ever feel like a deal might just evaporate before, you know, the ink even dries? What options do you actually have when you start getting that sinking feeling? Today, we're diving deep into a really fascinating 1981 Hawaii case, Romig v. DeValance. Now, okay, on the surface, it looks like a straightforward real estate squabble, right? But here's where it gets really interesting for us as future lawyers. This case shows us how courts can be creative, really creative, and borrow principles from completely different areas of law, specifically the Uniform Commercial Code. Yeah, the same rules that govern the sale of goods.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating here is how this case challenges, you know, the traditional silos of legal thought. For you law students listening, this isn't just some dusty old case to memorize for a contracts exam. It's a prime example of legal adaptability. It shows how courts can look beyond the usual frameworks to ensure fairness, you know, on all sorts of transactions. This case kind of challenges the traditional categories and suggests a more flexible approach to understanding contractual obligations.
Exactly. So the core question we're wrestling with today is this. Can a buyer in a land sale, like you might see this in a big property deal, can they demand assurance from the seller that they'll actually be able to deliver clear ownership? You know, just like a buyer of goods can demand proof the seller can still deliver if they have legitimate doubts. Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's lay out the situation in Romig v. DeValance.
Okay. The story starts back in 1976. The DeValances, they agreed to buy a condo from Romig. Price tag was $130,000. Now, it wasn't a simple cash transaction. It was an installment plan, meaning payments were spread out over time, with the final big chunk due in early 1981. And right after signing the agreement, the DeValances moved into the condo.
But almost immediately, their dream home started turning into a bit of a nightmare. We're talking significant construction problems, appliances that were basically DOA dead on arrival, you know, the kind of headaches any new homeowner would absolutely dread. But there was an even bigger cloud hanging over this deal, wasn't there?
Precisely. It turned out that a portion of the condominium, the actual structure, crossed over onto a neighboring property, an encroachment. This was a major, major problem with the title. It raised serious doubts about Romig's legal ability to deliver what he'd actually promised, full and clear ownership of the entire property.
Right. So naturally, the DeValances brought these issues to Romig's attention, including this encroachment problem. They even held back some payments at one point, hoping to get him to fix these problems. But then in 1977, there was a bit of a twist in the story.
Yeah, this is where the legal landscape gets a little more, complex. In exchange for getting more time to make a past due payment, the DeValances signed a waiver. Now, this waiver said they wouldn't sue Romig over the construction defects and the, you know, faulty appliances. However, and this is a really critical point, the encroachment issue was specifically not mentioned in this waiver. It was carved out, deliberately excluded.
Okay, so fast forward a few years, and Romig eventually sued to cancel the contract because the DeValances had, in fact, missed those payments again. The trial court sided with Romig. They granted what's called summary judgment. Essentially, the court said, look, you didn't pay, so the deal's off, without even having a full trial. But the DeValances weren't ready to just throw in the towel. They took it to the appellate court. Their argument was basically that Romig had failed to provide good title, or at least assure them he could, and that they had the right to demand some reassurance about it.
Which brings us right to the key legal questions the appellate court had to grapple with. First, by not fixing the encroachment, did Romig violate any guarantees about the quality of the ownership, the title he was supposed to provide? Second, and this is where that surprising UCC connection comes roaring back, could the DeValances, as buyers in a real estate deal, even ask Romig for proof that he could clear up this title issue? Like, is that even a thing in property law? And finally, was the trial court actually right to make a final decision without a full trial, given all these unresolved questions?
And, well, as we hinted earlier, the appellate court said, hold on a minute, not so fast. They overturned the summary judgment. But the reasoning behind that decision, that's really the core of what makes this deep dive so valuable for us.
Yeah, what's truly fascinating here is the court's thinking process. They looked at this real estate situation, remember? It's about land, a condo, and they made a direct comparison, an analogy, to sections 2609 and 2610 of the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, these sections deal with something called the right to adequate assurance of due performance. And what happens if someone basically indicates they won't follow through on their promises, but in contracts for the sale of goods?
Okay, let's break down this UCC connection a little more. For those who might not be, you know, knee-deep in the UCC every single day, what do these sections actually say? And why on earth did the court think they were relevant to a condo sale in Hawaii?
Well, think of it this way. If you're buying, say, 1,000 widgets, and you suddenly hear the seller's factory just burned down, or they're facing major financial problems, you'd naturally want to know if they can still deliver what you paid for, right? UCC 2609 gives you, the buyer, the right to ask for that reassurance, maybe a written guarantee that they will perform. You need adequate assurance. And under 2610, if they don't provide that assurance when you have reasonable grounds to ask, or if it's just plain obvious they won't perform anyway, that's anticipatory repudiation, it can be seen as a signal they're backing out of a deal early, which gives you, the worried party, certain options, like suspending your own performance or suing immediately. The Hawaii court is essentially asking, why shouldn't a condo buyer have that same basic right if they discover a major problem, like an encroachment, with the ownership of the property they're buying?
Okay. So the Hawaii court reasoned that this encroachment issue gave the Devalances what they called reasonable grounds for insecurity, basically, a legitimate reason to doubt Rumig's ability to deliver clear title by the time that final payment was due in 1981. Therefore, the court argued, the Devalances had the right to demand some kind of assurance from Rumig that he was actually going to fix this problem.
That's the key insight. Exactly. Even though the final transfer of the property deed wasn't scheduled for years down the line, the court recognized that a significant title defect right now could understandably make the buyers worried, make them doubt the seller's ability to fulfill their end of the bargain later on. And importantly, this right to ask for reassurance existed, the court said, even though it wasn't explicitly written into the original real estate contract. It's like an implied right based on good faith and fair dealing.
And the fact that the 1977 waiver specifically didn't include the encroachment issue,
yeah,
that became absolutely critical, this whole thing, right?
Oh, absolutely pivotal. Couldn't be more important. Because the waiver only covered the construction defects and the appliance problems, the Devalances hadn't given up their right to be concerned about the title. The unresolved encroachment remained a valid, live reason for them to feel insecure about the whole deal and, potentially, to demand some reassurance from Rumig about fixing it.
So, hypothetically, if Rumig didn't provide adequate assurance after the Devalances raised their concerns about the encroachment, what would be the legal consequences then?
Well, that's where this idea of potential anticipatory repudiation comes back into play, but now in the real estate context. If Rumig, when faced with a reasonable demand to show he could clear the title, assuming the Devalances made such a demand clearly, if he just stayed silent or didn't take any meaningful action to address the encroachment, the court suggested that this failure could be interpreted as a sign of repudiation indicating he wouldn't be able to deliver clear title when the time came for the final closing.
And this is the crucial reason why the summary judgment was overturned. The appellate court basically said the trial court hadn't properly looked into these key factual issues. Like, did the Devalances actually have a good, reasonable reason to be worried about the title because of the encroachment? Did they actually ask Rumig clearly for reassurance about fixing it? And crucially, what was Rumig's response, or maybe his lack of response? And could that inaction be seen as him effectively backing out of the deal early? These were all important disputed facts that needed a proper examination and a full trial, not just a quick decision based on the missed payments alone.
Exactly right. The appellate court wasn't making a final judgment on who was right or wrong in the end. Not at all. Instead, they were saying, look, there are real disagreements here about key facts that need to be sorted out through a full legal process, discovery, testimony, the whole nine yards. For example, you know, was the encroachment really significant enough to create a genuine, reasonable fear about the title's validity? That's a factual question. Did the Devalances' communications with Rumig actually constitute a clear demand for assurance about the title issue? Another factual question. And how did Rumig respond, or perhaps did he respond at all? And was that response, or lack thereof, reasonable given the circumstances? All stuff for a trial court to figure out.
Okay, so let's zoom out a bit from the specifics. What are the big takeaways from Rumig v. Devalance that our listeners, as you know, future legal eagles, should really lock onto?
Well, I think the first major takeaway is the court's sheer willingness to think outside the traditional boxes and apply principles from the UCC designed for goods to a real estate transaction. This case really shows us that when fairness and, frankly, good business sense are on the line, courts might just adapt legal ideas from one area to another, even when it involves something as fundamental and traditionally distinct as land ownership. It highlights that the core idea underpinning much of contract law ensuring parties can trust that the other side will actually hold up their end of the bargain isn't limited to just sales of goods. It's a broader principle.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the second really important point, it seems, underscores just how absolutely crucial it is to be precise when you're drafting contracts, especially when it comes to things like waivers. The fact that the DeValance's waiver specifically carefully excluded the encroachment issue was key to their ability to even make this argument in court, if that waiver had been broader.
Oh, if it had just been a general waiver of all claims, yeah, the whole outcome might have been drastically different. It's a stark reminder, really, that the smallest details, the specific wording in a contract, can have huge legal consequences down the line. Waivers need to be written with extreme care, clearly spelling out exactly what rights are being given up and which are being preserved. Any ambiguity, any vagueness, can lead to major legal battles.
Definitely a lesson there. And finally, this case seems to have some real-world implications for future real estate deals, doesn't it? It suggests that buyers aren't necessarily powerless if they develop valid concerns about a seller's ability to deliver on their promises, like clear title, even well before the final closing date. They might have a legal leg to stand on to seek some clarity, some assurance, and critically, a seller's failure to provide that might have serious consequences for the seller.
Precisely. It potentially gives buyers a tool, maybe leverage, to proactively address potential title problems or other fundamental issues instead of just sitting around waiting anxiously for a breach to actually happen at closing, which might be too late. You could argue it encourages sellers to be more upfront and transparent in real estate transactions, especially complex ones like installment sales, because they know the buyer might have this right to demand assurance if problems arise.
So thinking about this case then, how might these ideas of reasonable insecurity and adequate assurance pop up in other types of contracts you're setting, not just real estate or goods? Could Romegg v. DeValance maybe signal a broader trend of courts borrowing principles from the UCC, applying them in areas beyond just the sale of goods? It's definitely something worth pondering, as you continue your legal journey through contracts and beyond.